And I do believe that some prophecies were given expressly by God to mark out a particular epoch or event that was to occur in the outworking of his purpose, which once done, once accomplished, was fulfilled. And we can take it as fulfilled. Now, having said that, there are clearly some passages where we believe there is a warrant, a reason for a latter-day application being at least a possibility, and that the context itself, we believe, might require that. So let's imagine that we've got a prophecy about a nation or a people or a place that's already had a past fulfillment, and we think there's going to be a future fulfillment. What will the rules of prophetic interpretation be as to how we might apply the terms of that prophecy for some latter-day application? And I think the answer is that perhaps this is the best way of seeing it. That we will either see an application in terms of powers manifesting the same attributes. In other words, a power that in the latter days manifests the same spirit or the same characteristic, the same hostility or the same support as whatever the nation or entity was when the initial application came to pass. So we expect to see the same characteristics, the same attributes manifested by a power in the latter days, so that it could be said to be seen that they've assumed the mantle, as it were. And if not manifesting the same attributes, then the other possibility would be powers controlling the same territory. So either a power that, whether in a different location or not, shows the same characteristics as a power of ancient times, or alternatively a power that sits on exactly the same territory. Or, as I've said here, it could even be both of them. Now, there's an interesting set of prophecies that we won't go to today about the Palestinians. And the Palestinians, of course, the word Palestina in the Old Testament is the same word as Philistine. It's derived from the word Philistine. And it's interesting that the Palestinians of today, especially in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, manifest the same spirit as the Philistines of old, and also just happen to control the same territory as the Philistines of old. And because some of the passages concerning Palestina are couched inside prophecies that clearly have a latter-day application to and with and for Israel, and we assume that there might be a latter-day application of the Palestinian content in that prophecy as well. And so in that particular case, you've got a double application. You've got a power that actually sits on the same piece of land and manifests the same spirit as that very same entity of ancient days. So let me give you an illustration of what we mean by either a power manifesting the same attribute or a power that might control the same territory. If you come to the book of Obadiah, I was going to say the book of Edom, but it's sort of almost that, isn't it? The book of Obadiah, and if you read the words of the prophecy of Obadiah and in the 8th verse, we've got part of a prophecy concerning the matter of Edom. Now, I don't want to go into this in detail today because it's not the burden of our subject for this morning, but many of you will be aware that there's more than one application that's been made prophetically to Edom, and that Edom, of course, may very well be representative of a whole characteristic, a whole attitude, a whole frame of mind in relation to Israel that's taken up by powers in the latter days, which might geographically be somewhere altogether compared to where Edom was in ancient times, but they very much represent the spirit of Edom. Now, don't you think that that's the case in this passage here in Obadiah? It says, for example, if I just have a look, verse 3, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee. Verse 4, though thou exalt thyself as the eagle and set thy nest among the stars, I'll bring thee down. If thieves come to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? And as we come through this particular prophecy, we come to the 8th verse, "Shall I not in that day, saith Yahweh, even destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau?" Verse 10, "For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever in that day that thou stoodst on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them." What's the dominant idea here? Power on the same territory, or power manifesting the same characteristics? If we were to take a latter-day application of Obadiah, it's clearly to do with the spirit, isn't it? And the characteristics of Edom, seen in some way or in some capacity in the future, in a latter-day application. So that's clearly a possibility in terms of a latter-day prophetical fulfillment, is that we've got a power manifesting the same attribute. Now come to the book of Daniel in chapter 11, and you'll remember that in the story of the king of the north, at the end of the 11th chapter of Daniel, we're told that the king of the north comes down into the territory of the Middle East. In fact, we're told in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 41, "He shall enter also into the glorious land, the goodly land, the land of Israel, the promised land." And having done that, it says, he shall enter into the glorious land. Many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. We suddenly realize that in Daniel chapter 11, we've got another prophecy concerning Edom. But do you think that the prophecy concerning Edom in Daniel 11, which clearly must have a latter-day application because verse 40 says at the time of the end, is it about a power manifesting the same attribute as Edom or a power on the same territory? What's the context? The context is clearly about geography, isn't it? It's about the sweep of the king of the north through Israel, down into Egypt, but other areas, other territories escape out of his hand. So in this particular case, the context gives us the warrant to assume that the Edom, in this case that escapes, is whatever power controls the same territory as Edom at the time of the advance of the king of the north. It's not about characteristics. It's about territory. So the context determines, if there is a latter-day application, which of those two things, or whether both, might be involved in that latter-day application. Powers manifesting the same attributes, powers controlling the same territories. Yes?
I was wondering if you could go back to Obadiah and show how we know that it has a latter-day application.
I don't want to digress into that if I can avoid it. All I'm saying is that if there was a latter-day application, the spirit of Obadiah is not so much about Edom as a geographical place, is it? That the whole burden of Obadiah is a prophecy very much concerned with the characteristics of Edom as a people. So without digressing into whether there is or not a latter, all I'm saying is if there was a latter-day application, we'd be looking for it under this heading rather than under this heading in terms of the language of the whole of the prophecy of Obadiah. It's more centred on that idea of attributes, not territory. Now, having said all of that, what's interesting is that there are some prophecies which, although given with an historical context, as every prophecy I think has, they don't appear to have had a previous fulfillment at all. And we come to the conclusion that both the primary and the final, the only consummation, lies in a latter-day application of the prophecy. Some don't appear to have had any fulfillment. Some prophecies have not only been fulfilled, but we think they're completely fulfilled. They're past, they're finished, they're done, they're accomplished. There's no warrant, there's no basis for a latter-day application. Other prophecies don't ever seem to have been fulfilled. They're at the opposite end of the spectrum, as it were, aren't they? Now, why that's interesting, of course, is because for purposes of our weekend study here, we're looking at Ezekiel 38. And Ezekiel 38 appears to be such a unique prophecy. It's one of those that we're expressly told, are we not, in the chapter, that it applies to the latter days. Twice in this chapter, in the latter days, is the timetable for the invasion by Gog into the Middle East. And given that that's the case, we also know that there is no known antecedent or previous fulfillment. We know there was an allusion to the Scythians, but that wasn't a fulfillment. By the time Ezekiel writes, remember, the Scythians have already come and gone, and they never came again. So as far as we're aware, historically, Ezekiel 38 never ever had an initial or a primary fulfillment of this particular prophecy. It's almost as if it waits to the time of the end. It's a once and only prophecy, which brings its own unique problems in terms of how the rules of prophetic interpretation might apply. So let me just come to that then, in terms of what the implications might be concerning that. Because you see, if you stop and think about it, although there are prophetic overtones of past events in Ezekiel 38, I think it would be fair to say that the dominant aspect is not one of powers manifesting the same attributes. Just ignoring Gog for a moment, when we come to Persia and Tagama and Gomer, it doesn't say anything about Gomer's attributes, does it? Whoever the Gomer is of the prophecy, it's not about characteristics. It's presumably geographical, territorial. Instead, what we've got in this prophecy are a whole series of specific nations which are mentioned earlier in the book of Ezekiel. Most of these nations have already been mentioned somewhere else by Ezekiel. So they're clearly nations and territories, powers. And so the focus of this prophecy seems to be mainly concerning powers on territories rather than the manifestation of the same attributes. We know very little. We know next to nothing about any of the attributes of the nations mentioned in this chapter. So are you happy with that so far? So am I. So that's good, isn't it? So here's the problem. I'll just finish the slide and then you can see whether your question is related to the problem or separate and in addition to the problem, in which case I'll be pleased to take it at that point. Here's the problem then with regard to Ezekiel 38. And it's relevant because what we're going to be doing this morning, and this afternoon for that matter, is a fair bit of workshop activity trying to track down the nations of this chapter. Now, tracking down is the operative word, because where a prophecy has more than one fulfillment, everyone would understand that any final application would be applied to the same territory. If you've got a prophecy about a territory that's happened in the past, you think it's a latter-day application, you'd say, well, it's going to take place on that same territory. But where there's a prophecy that's never had a past fulfillment, you've now got to decide whether the power or the territory that the prophecy refers to is going to be located where it was at the time of writing or where it will be at the time of fulfillment, if there's only ever one fulfillment. So what do you think about that in terms of what conclusion we might come to on that matter? Any thoughts? Now that's an interesting answer. I definitely see an argument being made both ways. Well, it's good that you say that, because that's probably how we're going to do our workshops. I think what we're going to do is start by trying to track down where we think these powers were at the time Ezekiel wrote. Having said that, I'm not convinced that that's what we ought to be looking for at the time of the end, where you've got a prophecy that only ever occurs once in all of history. Did Ezekiel identify, through the power of the Spirit, the players who will happen to be in the places they need to be at the time the prophecy is fulfilled? Now, why that's interesting is because as we come to our workshops and map this stuff out a little bit later on today, what we will discover is that some of the powers in Ezekiel 38 have migrated since Ezekiel, but in fact some of them haven't. But I think that whether they've migrated or not, that I feel inclined towards the idea that we're looking to locate all of these powers, in fact, where they end up at the time of the prophecy, because it's a singular once in a lifetime, once in the whole history of time, a singular fulfillment. Now, you can debate that if you want to. My personal view is that in the end, is probably the better contextual approach, but I think there's a dilemma here. and it's a unique dilemma that can only apply really to such prophecies that appear to have no other previous fulfillment. So before I take Ben's, just so that I'm fair in terms of order, so first of all, the House of Styles.
So under bullet point number two, were you talking about the prophecy as a whole? Because yesterday with Go, you mapped out some very specific like behavioral attributes in terms of, you know, religiously cunning and aggressive.
Yes, most of those, however, were drawn by a compendium of a set of scriptures rather than being an analysis out of Gog, out of Ezekiel 38. And so if you were to in fact look at the characteristics, most of the inferences we took out of Ezekiel 38 were supported by other passages rather than the Ezekiel 38 passage itself. Now, it's true that it says he's an invading power. He obviously comes with hostile intent. But I still think that the bulk of the prophecy is geographical in its dimension. Ben?
So you mentioned the fact that we're looking at territories, but there is specific mention of location within Daniel 11 and within Ezekiel 38, and it's the uttermost parts of the north. So I think that has to be taken in context here, because if the writer is telling us, here are names which you might be familiar with, but I'm going to give you a location, and that location is as far north as anyone is familiar with, which I would assume is what uttermost parts of the north might be interpreted as, that has to give you a strong indication of where to look. And if you're looking at nations, you know, from that, from the perspective of the writer, you know, you look at those nations and you look at the location, and you put the two together. You have to look at both. And you're given that strong indication of location.
I would probably take that comment and promote you to the head of the class, at least momentarily, because... because Ben's just mentioned what I think is the critical answer to the puzzle. See, imagine the uniqueness of a prophecy that's being given by Ezekiel where there will only ever be one fulfillment. He's going to refer to nations which must have been at least recognizable in his day. He wasn't referring to a set of nations that were so obscure that nobody had a clue what it was all about. I think the nations were all recognizable, must have been so in the prophet's own day, but they weren't necessarily in the spots and the locations where they would be when the prophecy was about to be fulfilled. But I think that Ezekiel gives a clue, and the clue is the clue that Ben suggests. And I think that that clue irresistibly drives us to the conclusion of taking the powers and territories as being where they will be at the time of fulfillment. Now, just come to Ezekiel 38, and we'll just have a look at that. Because it's the only geographical clue, it's the only geographical clue that the prophet gives us, and I might just add that I believe that at the time Ezekiel gives this clue, it's not where the relevant nation was. So we rest our case, mutually and jointly and severally, concurrently and contemporaneously together. So, in Ezekiel 38, it says, verse 2, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, of the land of the Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. So we're going to try and figure out where all these nations began and how the story goes. But when we come to verse 15, we're expressly told this, the only geographical bit, and thou, Gog, shalt come from thy place, out of the north parts. Now, north parts is a fairly ambiguous term, isn't it? You could say that anything north of, presumably, Israel. I know that Ezekiel is prophesying from Babylon, isn't he? He's in captivity at the time. But I don't think it was due north of Babylon that the prophet has in mind. I think it's due north of the mountains of Israel, which are the scene of the invasion. Thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts, coming down into Israel, against my people Israel, verse 16. Ah, but that phrase, from thy place out of the north parts, Rotherham says, from the remote parts. The Revised Standard Version says, out of the uttermost parts of the north. The uttermost parts of the north. And even in Ezekiel's day, and here's the evidence, a certain Scythian invasion of recent time showed that there were powers that lay beyond the Caucasus Mountains to the north of the Black and Caspian Seas. So when Ezekiel said the uttermost parts of the earth, there was knowledge even then of powers that lay that far north. So what would you make of the phrase, the uttermost parts of the north, the remotest parts of the north? That's quite a singular comment, isn't it? It's from there that Gog in particular comes. Not necessarily all the surrounding nations. I think that's a reference to Gog himself, because it says that, doesn't it? Verse 14. In the day when my people of Israel dwelleth safely, shalt thou, Gog, not know it? Or as the Septuagint says, wilt thou not rouse thyself, and thou shalt come from thy place out of the uttermost parts of the earth, verse 16, and thou shalt come against my people. This is the location clue for Gog himself. Gog comes from the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, I believe that at the time that Ezekiel wrote that, the actual Rus by name may not have all been in the uttermost parts of the earth, but it's where they were going to become. It's where they were going to end up. So, look, I know you can debate this, but I believe that Ben's comment is correct and that the prophet furnishes us with a relevant clue in terms of the ultimate destiny of the invading power. Yes, of the north quarters. The difference between that, now that's Tagama of the north quarters, so Tagama's got to be north as well, but I think the phrase in the Hebrew, the north quarters, is not as powerful and strong as the phrase out of the north parts in verse 15. I guess we'd have to check that in some translations, maybe even look up for the first time a Hebrew word and see what we thought of that. Yes?
How about verse 2 in chapter 39?
Verse 2 in chapter 39. Cause he to come up from the north parts. Yes, exactly. Now, the margin says there the sides of the north. So that appears to be a third phrase. So the difference is, though, that the phrase in verse 6 is about Tagama, not Gog. But the phrase in 38, 15 and 39, 2 are clearly both about Gog. So, yes, they'd both be very relevant passages to look up. So there is a geographical clue. So, look, I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say about the rules of prophetic interpretation. But if you've never come across those before, I think that's very helpful, thinking about those two ideas, either a power manifesting the same attributes or a power sitting on the same territory is the standard rule of prophetic interpretation for latter-day applications. The only reason we may take a slightly different view on the case of Ezekiel 38 is, well, where would you think we should take the powers? Where they were at the time of the writing, or where they are at the time of the prophecy, it could be debated, but my view is that that I lean towards the second as being more relevant, given the uniqueness of a singular, once-ever application of a prophecy, that you're looking for where all those things, where all those powers will be at the time the prophecy is fulfilled. Which just leads to a couple of other observations relating to questions that came in yesterday, and they're the same, really, is... One of the questions was about the walls and gates, since we're not going to talk about that, the land of unwalled villages. How's that going to happen, having neither bars nor gates? And the answer is, all the prophecy requires is that there be no walls or gates at the time Gog invades. So we might look at Israel today and say, well, you know, they're in control, but there's lots of problems. They're still building walls. There's lots of barbed wire. It doesn't seem to be Ezekiel 38. Look, don't you think that one enormous battle against the Arabs, so notice what I've said here, I don't believe that it's all improbable that there might be another Jewish-Arab battle. I'm not saying that there isn't a Jewish-Arab controversy. I'm not saying there may not be another Jewish-Arab battle. What I am saying is it's not the great biblical event at the time of the end in terms of the prophetical outline. But were there to be another battle, which this time Israel wins and wins decisively, so decisively that they put a ring of steel around Israel, clean out the West Bank, deal with Hamas, blitzkrieg the Hezbollah in Lebanon so that the Arabs don't even know what hit them, because the Israelis have been caught napping, haven't they, the last couple of times. One would imagine that the next time they've got a few scores to settle. Imagine a battle that decisive that the whole Arab world reels in shock They've just got no idea where all that came from. And for a period of time, peace settles in the Middle East to the point where at last Israel says, we can relax. No one's going to touch us for at least a decade because the Arabs are all A, in shock, and B, as usual, completely disunited as they all argue with each other as to whose fault it was. Now, how quickly could the circumstances of Ezekiel 38 come to pass? No bars, no gates. We may not even see that. We may already be called away by Christ before the circumstance of Ezekiel 38 falls exactly into position. We may not see all the final details. So when people postulate how this could happen, it could happen just like that. And it could happen after we've gone. So the critical thing with Ezekiel 38 is that what is required is that these be the circumstances and these be the powers and these places at the time the invasion occurs. No more. So that's our half hour gone precisely. So what we'll do is we'll take a break for 5 minutes just so you can stretch your legs. And then we're going to come back into Ezekiel 38. And at last we're going to deal with, is Russia really mentioned in this chapter?